This is File 36, Cycle 2. Today's date is August 2nd, 2016. This is Gene McMillan. I am interviewing Robert O'Brien on his life and experiences up on Mount Riga. And first we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Robert O'Brien.
And your birth date, please?
20th of March, 1939.
And where were you born?
In Manhattan, New York.
And your parents' names, please?
Robert Henry O'Brien and Louise Crosby McCabe O'Brien.
And do you have siblings?
I have three siblings. Well, I had three at birth.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth, who's deceased, Mary Louise, now known as Mariah.
With an H.
Who lives in Canada, and Margie Vale, who lives in Salisbury and Mount Riga. Margaret Claire O'Brien at birth.
Got it. Thank you. What is your education after high school?
I graduated from the Georgetown School of Foreign Service.
That's impressive. That's impressive.
What's that?
That's impressive. What's your connection with Mount Riga? Are you one of the original families?
Yes. My grandfather and grandmother built a camp on Mount Riga in 1906. My great-grandmother had become one of the original three shareholders. Well, mm-hmm. It wasn't a corporation at that time.
No, but it was the three original proprietors.
Three original people. And she divided her interest between my grandmother and my great uncle, Harry Wells.
Good. I'll get to wish come true eventually. But I want to start with the horse, Chiefy.
Oh, Chiefy.
What did Chiefy look like?
Chiefy was very large for a pony. Everybody who saw him and knew about ponies was surprised when I said he was a pony and not a horse. He was as big as a lot of horses. He was stocky and strong. And was mostly white, had some brown on his face, and I think on his chest.
Do you remember how many hands high he was? That's an awful question.
Something like 12, I think.
That would be about right.
Something like that.
How did you get him?
My Uncle Frank McCabe, owned him. They had a big house in Albany where they kept horses, as well as coming to Mount Riga in the summer. And
you're doing fine.
He had two daughters, my cousins Polly and Tinker, who were older than I was, and both now deceased. And they tired of the pony at some point, and Uncle Frank offered him to me, and my parents let me accept. And so we had Chiefy on Mount Riga in the summer. He was already of quite advanced age. I don't know how old, but and that was understood that he might not last too long, but he lasted several years.
Yeah.
And we would take him down to White Plains, where we just barely had enough space to have a horse because we lived in sort of a suburban house. But my father owned the two houses next door, and all the yards sort of adjoined.
Yeah.
And there was an old stable because there were old houses. So anyway, I kept Chiefy in White Plains two or three winters, I think he survived.
Oh my.
And then the summers on Mount Riga, you know, so.
And was his name spelled Chiefy?
I guess so. I don't, it wasn't very often written, right?
Yeah, well.
Pretty much a verbal thing. You don't have to write. We didn't enter
any. You didn't have to write it.
Any competitions or anything. But he was trained and suitable to both pulling a wagon, mm-hmm. and being ridden with a saddle. And so I had a saddle and would ride. and I had an old U.S. Cavalry saddle, and which I think had come from my uncle Vin McCabe, my grandfather's brother, who was a veterinarian in Millbrook.
And his name was?
Vincent.
Okay, okay.
I had a two-wheel cart with a bench seat that we used a lot, much more than riding a saddle, because, of course, there was nobody else that had a horse, and I could only ride by myself. So, used the cart a lot, because then it was other kids could join in. I think I was 11 or 12 when I got Chiefy, sometime around.
That's about right. Because you would have to.
Or something.
You'd have to do all the care of him.
Yeah.
So you had to be old enough.
Yeah. And and then I had the farm cart that had four wheels, was 10 or 12 feet long. And that was the one I used to deliver water to camps on Mount Riga, mm-hmm. and pick up pig food, garbage, really. My Uncle Spaulding McCabe owned the pigs and had them at Castanook, where we stayed those summers. Mm-hmm. And he got separate brand new garbage cans, little ones.
Now,
and
these would have been metal?
Metal. They're galvanized. All garbage cans in those days were galvanized metal and had lids. And these were maybe 10 gallons, smaller than people usually used. And the customers or camp owners mm-hmm. who wanted their garbage removed free had to separate the edible part for the pigs and put it in those cans and the other part. And I had to take away both. And I took the... I had two routes with five or six people on each one. One went towards the upper lake and one went up on the hill at the lower lake. And then I'd go back and feed the pigs and fill up the water jug. That was it. My uncle paid me something. I don't remember what. But
oh, good.
And the people paid me for water, because that was sort of my own business. He hadn't incorporated that. I added that to the business. So, but he paid me something for feeding the pigs.
How many pigs did he have, you know? Do you remember?
There was a big sow.
I mean,
a huge pig that weighed like 300 pounds.
Ooh.
And a varying number of
piglets.
Piglets, yeah.
Was that for the war effort?
That's where it started. Most of his years were actually right after the war,
mm-hmm.
Because it would have gone on.
It was still rationing.
1950, 51, you know, 52.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had chickens at Castanook for the war effort, but right after the war she got rid of those. But Uncle S kept breeding the pigs. He would keep the sow over the winter somewhere. I don't know where, not in Mount Riga. And then when I got there in the summer, there would be a litter of little pigs. And then I think before winter, he sold them to the butcher.
Probably. How often did you do the garbage water route?
It seems like I did it every other day, so probably 3 days a week. I'm not absolutely certain. And it seems like I did it both. I did both routes one day, rather than, I think, looking back, mm-hmm. I'd do one day, one the other day. But it seems like I'd do one, I'd go back sometimes, I would have breakfast, and then go in the other direction and do the other one.
What did you keep the water in?
A large galvanized, like a 25-gallon galvanized garbage can that I bought again, because they had to be brand new, obviously.
Oh, sure.
And had a brass tap soldered into mm-hmm. the bottom of it, so I could
draw out water.
Fill it with buckets, but I could, or a pipe, but I filled it with buckets actually, and from the well at Castanon, and which water, of course,
that's
people
beautiful.
Are not right,
oh,
still
that's gorgeous
use.
Water.
And then I could draw water and fill whatever jugs people had.
Because there was no running water as such up there, so you delivered water
anybody
to them.
Who had running water, so, still now, pump it out of the lake.
Oh, yeah.
And
sure.
While I can't know of anybody who's died from drinking the lake water, and I certainly have drunk a lot of it,
yeah.
People prefer to drink the well water, and it's recommended.
So this was drinking water, specifically.
It was drinking water, yes, yes. People had water for other purposes.
Yeah, they, just for like, washing dishes
like
and clothes.
People would get 2 or 3 gallons of water a couple times a week to drink.
Okay.
In those days, people used to buy ice, too, you know.
Now, did one of the Brazy boys deliver the ice?
Yes, Bud or David Brazy and his son Peanut.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to Peanut. He was, I think, Bud's oldest son by his first wife.
Yeah, that gets a little complicated, I know. Because when I was teaching, I had Teddy Brazy and I had Margaret Brazy.
Uh-huh.
And that was of that family somewhere in there.
Yeah, but I think those are Kathleen's children.
Yes, that was the second wife, not the first wife.
Now, Kathleen was born either in Canada or in Ireland and came to Salisbury to care for me. My mother brought her here from New York City.
Ah, well, that's wonderful.
When I was born, or when I was a
little
infant.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen took care of me when I was a little kid, and so she always had a particular interest in me and my children.
Of course.
When her last days, when she really didn't go out of the house, if I went up and down the road, she would know how often I had gone up and down the road.
Oh, yeah.
And if I didn't stop and see her,
She'd be upset.
Oh,
sure.
When I would stop, she'd say, "You've been going up and down." And I said, "Well, sometimes I'm very busy, but, you know," or I wanted to bring my children. I wouldn't, my
yeah.
children were there, because she always wanted to see my children. I said, "Well, I didn't have the children, because..."
But, you know, that's so nice to have the continuum and the interest and the care.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's absolutely marvelous. Okay. Tell me about the flood of 1955, and let's start with the war wagon. What was the war wagon?
The war wagon was a vehicle that the Red Cross in White Plains, or Westchester County, had. That's where we lived at that time.
Mm-hmm.
During the war, it was built on a Dodge car, but they had cut out the back of the car. It had 4 doors, like a mm-hmm. car all cars had in those days.
Yep.
No, they were 2-door cars. But anyway, like a 4-door car. But then it was elongated, and it had dual wheels on the back like a truck, and a huge wooden body like station wagons
mm-hmm.
in the 1940s and 50s,
sure.
except much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like 5 feet high inside. You couldn't quite stand up, but it was
pretty close.
Big. And in the back, it had bench seats that folded up against the sides of the thing, so presumably you could put stretchers. I don't think we ever had, in White Plains during the war, a emergency. But
oh, good.
Certainly nothing related to the war. There may
yeah.
have been other things that they used it for. And then there was the front seat was very typical. You know,
yeah, ambulance seat.
Original seat from the car, and where the back seat should have been, there was just like a step up to get on this deck that went back to the back.
Okay.
But sitting down, you could carry 14 people.
Good heavens.
And if you just piled kids in there,
oh, yeah.
How many? So, anyway, during the flood, that was at the upper lake, so that when the roads washed down, it could only move from the upper lake to the lower lake. That was as far as it could go. I was not on Mount Riga when the flood actually happened, because by that time I was old enough to have a summer job, and I was working for an engineering surveying company down in Westchester County in Pleasantville, actually. And I owned a Jeep, a 1946 civilian Willys Jeep. It was like the first civilian Jeep they sold after the war. Mm-hmm. And I got the Jeep up to the lower lake, but I couldn't get it up to the upper lake. And I think I must have done that by driving through Massachusetts.
Probably, coming down Mount Washington Road.
And come down, because there's no bridges on that road.
No, there aren't.
Now,
tell me the story with the ice. That's where I'm going. Tell me the story with the ice at the hurricane. You got a phone call.
Oh, yes. I got a call. I was in my planes, and somehow it seems my mother wasn't there. I don't know where she... I guess she was on the mountain. I don't know. But anyway, that I shouldn't come on Friday, which I normally would have done, which would have got me up there in the dark, but that I should come on Saturday, actually up the New York State Road, what we called the K Road, went up to the K Camp on the New York side of the Upper Lake, and I should stop in Rudd Pond and buy 300 pounds of ice.
Ooh.
And bring 300 pounds of ice up to the K Camp and get one of their boats and bring it across the lake, because they were out of ice, or were going to run out of ice.
300 pounds is a lot of ice.
Well, that was, there were,
were they?
And that day at Wish Come True, there were three camps, and everybody typically put 100 pounds of ice in their fridge every week. So, because David couldn't get up with his truck, that would have been, that would have kept him going for a week.
Then they would be in 100-pound chunks.
When Bud brought them, they were in 100-pound or 50-pound chunks that he would chop them. But in Rudd Pond, actually, I found out they only sold them in 25-pound chunks.
Because I was wondering, how are you going to handle that amount of... Because
right.
I remember ice being delivered with the leather pad and the tongs, and they were probably 25 or 30 pounds.
Right.
Okay.
Well, the ice, the way they sold it here, was 100-pound chunks, mm-hmm. or they would chop them in 50 or 25. They had a sort of line that was formed in the ice when they made it in the ice factory.
Yeah.
And one of the things that marveled us, that Bud, who was not a very big guy, could carry 100 pounds of ice with ice tongs.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
He could carry 100 pounds of ice and then open the top of the ice box
and sling it in.
Sling it in there.
Yep.
And it just yep. went in like boom.
Yep. And he knew what he was doing.
Yes.
He knew what he was doing. Who were some of the kids that you played with up on the mountain?
Around that time, as I said, when I grew up, and particularly at the upper lake before we went down to Castanook, which I think it was probably 1948, the summer of that summer, but I'm not sure. But it was mostly girls. There were my three sisters, three Lawler girls, and my cousins, Ellen and Skeety McCabe, Ambrose McCabe's children. But down at the lower lake, and of course I went down there, even though Dwight Bim Collin was considerably older than me, and we never played together that much. But
now, Bim Collins camped with my husband's nephew, Eddie Kiera.
Ah.
And I learned that because I was doing Dwight and Mary Collin.
Right.
And I haven't had a chance to get a hold of Eddie and tell him that.
Uh-huh.
But it's a wonderful connection. I was so pleased with that.
All right. Well, but then Dwight Collin, Robbie, and particularly Chet Sawtelle, mm-hmm. Gordy Chapman, if he was there,
yep.
And Donnie Lippincott, who used to visit the Chapmans. He's a cousin, I think, but in other words, his family didn't stay on Mount Ragam. Well, his mother would sometimes come. They're related to the Wellses, too. But, and then younger than me, but we sometimes played together, there was Jimmy Dresser, Mike McCabe, and who, of course, is my cousin,
yep.
And Steve Griggs.
And all three I've interviewed.
Uh-huh.
All three of them.
Those were the little kids then. We were older. They were little ones.
Because when I was doing Mike McCabe, he was the one that told me about Chiefy and the garbage detail. And he said, but you've got to get Robbie because he'll know more about it than I am. So, you know, and it's wonderful when these interviews dovetail with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the whole thing more full, which is what I'm looking for.
But Jimmy has also collected stories about the hurricane, you know, so he was very impacted by that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Had a party a couple of years ago at the 50th anniversary of the Great Flood.
Ah.
And a lot of people told stories.
Oh, that must have been fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Now, you had a story that you told about a bulldozer.
Yes. And I think that was the aftermath of the flood.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably the next year. I don't know. But obviously there was a lot of... They had to completely reconfigure the road around the Lower Lake Dam.
Because it had washed out?
It had... The
dam went...
The road had washed out, and the hillside that used to hold the road was gone. I mean, it was the whole thing... Well, the river had reconfigured the terrain, and they had to put back a road and do things. And there were a couple of bulldozers up there at various times. But this one, I couldn't tell you what the exact model it was, but it was not very big, and it was parked in the field below Castanook. And nobody was around. It was probably on a weekend. But it seemed like nobody was around. It may have been even in the fall before a Mount Raga meeting. I don't know. But anyway, what I do know is that Chet and Dwight, I think, I'm not sure if anybody else, but Chet and Dwight and I were there, and Chet said he knew how to start the bulldozer, and it didn't have a key, or the key was in it, or something, and so of course we said, well, let's go drive the bulldozer. So, we started up the bulldozer, and I'm sure Chet was driving, and it was a thing you had to drive with levers. It doesn't have a steering wheel. You had to drive with levers. And it was sort of jerky the way it... And so Dwight and I were sitting on the
seat.
Fenders, or beside the seat. The seat is really made for one person.
Oh, that's right. So you'd be on the sides.
So we're sort of hanging on the sides, and then... grass was tall, and the, whether from that work or something else, there was a mound of dirt and then a trench that the water from the well ran through. In those days, it didn't run through a pipe. It just came over the wall and ran like a little stream. So the bulldozer went up in the air and came down with the blade stuck into the thing, and I'm sure an experienced operator could have gotten it out of there. But we
weren't experienced.
We're not. And the motor stalled, which was good because the two of us were on the sides, found ourselves hanging over on the blade, and we probably would have been mangled by the treads if they'd been moving. But, and I don't remember if there was an actual siren or something, but we were convinced the police were coming. Anyway,
you never
saw police on Mount Ragam. But anyway, we got to get out of here. So we just
scattered,
abandoned the scene, and never told anybody. And I don't recall that anybody ever asked me about why the bulldozer was stuck in the mud rather than where they left it. But
oh, goodness. Oh, that's typical boys. Typical boys. I think I'm going to ask you about Castanook, and then I'm going to go back to Wish Come True.
Okay.
With Castanook, you rented it in the 40s?
Like my mother rented it in the 1940s. I'm not sure. There were two elements, and I'm not sure whether one came first or whether they were both combined in the same thing. One, that my father would be more comfortable there. My father, being a New York City, actually he was born in Brewster, but
yeah,
he chose the life in the city and was not so used to and up at Wish Come True, we had just separated the camp, and so my family just had a couple little cabins.
Mm-hmm.
That my father would be more, it had an indoor bathroom. And
oh, that makes a difference.
So, that my father would be more comfortable there. And frankly, to be, I think, a little further from some of my mother's family, you know, to be, because
mm-hmm.
at Wish Come True, you still were, and still are, all mixed up together.
Yeah.
The other was this idea to raise chickens for the war effort. And so she spent a good bit of money fixing up the house so somebody could live there year-round. And including, I think the system was there, but renovating a heat system. So it had a furnace in the basement, and it had regular radiators and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And putting in electric generator. Eventually there were actually two generators, and the house was wired for electricity. You could turn on a light and the batteries would start the generator, and all very downtown. It had a pressurized water system in the basement. She drilled that well, that's such a marvelous well, and put the water into the basement. Before that, the water from Castanook had come from a spring up on the hill, not very far up. You can still find the spring up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the pipe came down and actually went across the driveway above where the car, so you drove under a water pipe.
Yeah. I've been through Castanook, so at least I can visualize it.
Yeah, it came off that hill. There's an old chimney up there, and beside that, there's a thing. So anyway, I would say I was a child. I don't know the details of her motivation, but she did lease it from Mount Rag Incorporated for 10 years, and she
improved it,
renovated the barn. She put insulating board all over it and made it into a two-floor chicken house.
That's what I was going to ask you.
700 square feet on each floor, and actually moved the barn. The barn was back probably 100 yards behind the house, and they built a new foundation right behind where the well is and moved the barn up there and did all this insulating and everything. So it was a stone foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It must still be there, about that high,
mm-hmm.
with a concrete slab on top of it, and then the two-story chicken house, which was the converted barn, on top of that.
Would she have used local people for that, like the Lorenzos, perhaps?
Probably, yes. Yes.
So she wasn't importing from Brewster or White
Plains?
No.
Okay. It would have been
the locals.
The guys who worked there, the guy who lived there, name was Jack Shakespeare. I don't know where he came from. But the guys who worked there, and particularly after the war when Jack Shakespeare wasn't there,
mm-hmm.
and we had it in the summer, the guys who worked on the chickens were Balls and Sherwoods, both of them.
Oh, sure.
Whom are local families.
Oh, yeah, I have.
And the Sherwoods, one of them was championship ski jumper.
It was Roy. Yeah.
And she bought a Model A Ford car that was part of that operation, and it had a rumble seat.
Ooh.
But the rumble seat was removed before I saw it. Anyway, I don't know whether my mother had that done. And so what was in the back was a wooden deck. So it was effectively more like a pickup truck than a car. I assume it had it, at some point it had a canvas top, but that
was gone. Yeah.
So it had seats that got completely soaked when it was wet, and a wooden deck in the back. I think it had wire wheels. But it had a regular gearbox, a three-speed gearbox, which I never drove a Model T Ford. The old people used to talk about driving the Model T that didn't have a gearbox, so the Model A was, you know,
a great advance.
A gearbox.
I've seen them with the elliptical brakes.
Which also didn't work very well when it was wet.
No, they didn't.
And of course, on Mount Raga, things
get wet.
Frequently wet. Yep. So you had to be very careful and sometimes use the
emergency
brake, because the elliptical brakes wouldn't work. So you're going down somewhere and put the brake on,
and nothing would happen.
And you'd have to pull the emergency brake, which only worked on the rear brakes, I think. Anyway, it would stop you if you knew how to do it. Yeah. Of course, I wasn't old enough to legally drive, but I used to drive that. That was probably one of the first. The other vehicle she had was a 1938 Plymouth, which she had had from before the war. You know, we had that car during the war.
Oh, sure.
Which also had like a little pickup box in the back, because I think it had been in an accident, and rather than replace the trunk lid,
they put in a
little pickup box in the back. So we got a collection of sort of interesting non-standard vehicles.
Who was it that had the fire engine?
Uncle Frank, my mother's brother, Frank.
Okay, he had, yeah. And that was. Now, if I have the story right, that what I was told was he had the fire engine, and so when they went to insure some of the property, he said something to the effect that they had fire protection because he had the fire engine.
I couldn't verify that, but I have heard it.
Okay,
right?
that's all I need.
The insurance company bought it,
I don't know.
I have no idea. But if you were more than
3 miles
a certain number from miles from a firehouse, your went up, so that
where I live at the time that I built my house, I was 3 miles from the firehouse, so the insurance was low, and then they went and they moved the firehouse.
That's not fair.
I know. What happened after she got rid of the chickens? What happened to the hen house?
I used to sleep in it. Basically, the ground floor was nothing. It was just like storage space, you know, like junk. And the upper level, I slept in it in the summer with friends of mine who came from White Plains or other kids from Mount Raga.
Okay.
And it always smelled like chicken shit. I mean,
yeah, I would imagine so. It permeates.
It never, ever. The whole south wall was glass, and you could just remove the window frames. They were like just window frames that were just sort of put in there.
Yeah.
And so, unless it was terribly cold or something, we would just take them out and sleep over there near the fresh air.
Oh,
because
yeah.
if you went, it was, you know, not full height.
Mm-hmm.
And if you went over in the lower sections in the corners that didn't have windows, it was terrible. And so, the girls wouldn't go up there because it smelled so bad.
Oh, sure. Well, we're delicate, you see.
So, and there was still an old ice house at Castanook. I'm not sure if that's still there. And the privy was attached to the back of the outhouse, and there's a retaining wall there, which I'm sure is still there.
Yeah, it is.
And the outhouse was built so that, I mean, the ice house was built so that the ice, we put a floor in it and used it for like a tool shed and so forth. But before that, the ice had been down at a sort of lower level, and I guess you could put the ice in at the top and go down the bottom and get it out. And of course, it was, so that lower part was just sawdust, and we just built a floor over it and abandoned it. But the on the side of it was a privy, which was also not a hole in the ground like most of them were. It just was built out like a porch.
Yeah.
And then the house with the seat was out there. It was boarded up, but everything just dropped onto the ground.
Yeah, I've used a few of those. Was there, do you remember, if there was a log cabin behind Castor?
Yes, yeah, we called it Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Okay.
The, actually my mother had somebody and built a kitchen on the side of it and a porch. And the Lawlers stayed there. They always stayed with us every summer in the month of August. Uncle Tom was a college professor, first in Omaha, Nebraska, and then in Andover, Massachusetts. Anyway, so Uncle Tom and Aunt Peg and their three girls. I think the girls must have slept in the house
probably.
With my sisters, probably.
Rather than in the chicken.
Because the cabin only had one room. It didn't have a separate bedroom. But Uncle Tom and Aunt Peg stayed there. They had their own kitchen, and so they could like cook and so forth and be.
And again, if I've got this story right from Steve Griggs, he took it down and moved it and reconfigured it.
Yes. The logs are his cat camp now.
Yeah, and
yes.
I have been in that one too.
Right, okay.
Which was.
And I assume those are chestnut logs.
Yes, he said they were.
And I think the chimney is probably still up there. But it's not the one you can see from the road.
No, it's
that's an older one that's never been anything but a chimney in all my memory.
Okay.
But it's back away from the road a little more. And there actually was a road that went. Oh, I remember. They had a tent. They had a platform up there, a wooden platform, and a big tent. And the Lawler girls slept in the tent some of the time anyway.
Oh, okay.
And there was a road that went from behind where the barn was up to where the tennis courts are now.
Ah.
When I say a road, the remnants of a road, you could sort of see the thing and walk up there. All that area had obviously at one point been fields.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
So,
because it had all been cut over for the Ball Forge charcoal business.
For the charcoal thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But then they also raised sheep up there for a brief time. And, you know, in that area, like, there's stone walls in the woods and so forth. So it obviously had been sheep.
All righty. Yeah. Let's move on to Wish Come True.
Okay.
When was that built?
The main camp that I now have was built in the spring or early summer of 1906. One building was built the fall before and used to stable horses and store building material. That is now the cabin that Emily Vale sweeps in, right by the road.
Ah.
So that's actually the oldest building, and that was built in 1905, or the fall of 1905.
Okay.
And then there are log cabins and other cabins that were used for sleeping. I'm not sure what year they were built in. Some of them, I think, as late as the 1920s. Actually, the original barn was then in time of my mother's generation called the men's cabin, and apparently it had a lot of bunks in there, and she had three brothers, and any other single men that came along slept in that cabin. But they, I don't know when the other cabins were built.
But the main one is what I was looking for.
The main one was definitely built there.
And how long have you lived there? You said there were like three separate periods.
Well, yeah, I was there every summer from 1939, when I was born, until my parents split it up, which we have some, my mother and her brothers, I should say, split up the camp. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 1951, but after the war.
Okay.
And then my Uncle Ambrose got it, and I don't know exactly what year, but probably sometime in the early 70s when I was living in Jamaica, my mother, well, Ambrose and Betty wanted to build a new camp on vacant Wishcomtrue land, so they did a different subdivision of the 6 acres, and my mother then got the main camp and the buildings that she already had, which included the old barn and the one log cabin, the ones that Margie now has. And but she didn't choose to live in it, and she rented it to friends and family members, and my family and I came, we usually came for 2 weeks when we were living in Jamaica. So sometime during the summer, get vacation and come. Mm-hmm. And then after my mother died in 1983, Margie and I bought the buildings. We each bought the buildings. And
you bought the buildings from the corporation?
Yes, or from my mother's estate. I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether she owned them.
Whichever.
Personally, but anyway, we bought them so that we each now own the buildings, and we lease the land from Wishcomtrue, which includes my cousins. You know, this is not just Margie and I.
No, my cousins. Yeah.
So I've really been the owner of the camp, at least the building, since 1983.
And you lease the land from the Mount Riga Corporation?
No, from Wishcomtrue
Incorporated. That's a separate one, isn't it?
It's a separate corporation where all the heirs, heirs of my mother and her two younger brothers. The older brother, Frank, moved down to the Lower Lake.
Okay. We'll get all
one,
the corporations.
One wag... trying to explain real estate title issues on Mount Riga, said you never own anything on Mount Riga. You can't buy anything on Mount Riga, and you never own anything on Mount Riga except that you can inherit the right to spend money on it.
Ah. You know, that's probably right. Because older houses need a lot of maintenance. So you're always
fixing something.
Yeah.
Particularly old wooden buildings that.
Oh sure.
Are up on that climate and you know.
Because they weren't necessarily built on a stone or a cement foundation to begin with.
No.
So you
built
have
on masonry piers usually, and sometimes logs and various other stone outcroppings or whatever.
Oh. Okay.
And they weren't built to any
particular
building code either.
Yeah, I gathered that.
Well,
having been fortunate enough to have had a private tour of Castanook and seeing Wishcomtrue and going through Wentworth and going through Steve Griggs's cabin and Jim Dresser's house.
Yeah.
This is marvelous to me.
But that was built in, I have records up there in my grandmother's hand, but in about 6 weeks, by 8 or 9 people, including a brick chimney and 2 fireplaces.
Wish come true.
Wish come true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, I think it's 2,000 square feet of building, something like that. So that's pretty...
Yeah, it's pretty good.
You're hard to get that done today, I will say.
That's true. That's true.
But you don't some have of those guys came from Brewster. She documented that the head guy came from Brewster. Maybe somebody showed you that. The head guy brought some people from Brewster, and it's listed who the people were, and then it says, like, the last 4 or the last 5, something that were local people, so it mentions who they are.
Yeah.
One of the Lampsons, and I don't remember who the others. You have to look at the history book, the camp log. My grandmother wrote up something about
it. Well, good for her. Because, again... I've had Sherwoods in my class. I've had Lampsons in my class.
Yes.
So that, you know, the names mean something to me because I have had contact with the
Lampsons and Sherwoods and Balls.
Yeah, I never had any of the Balls.
Used to be, I don't know.
I think they've sort of died out.
Or
moved. But I've had the others.
Danny Brzee, the one who's alive now, mother is a Ball.
Yep.
She's the only one I've ever met.
Okay.
But there was Sid Ball, and there were a couple other Balls, and of course...
Charlie Ball.
Yes.
Yeah, Farnham Road.
And there are things like Ball Brook and...
Oh, sure, and Ball Forge.
Yes, okay. So obviously there were...
But it's nice to see the names attached to something and have a recollection about.
Yeah, I say, I have a recollection. I remember particularly... I think the 2 Sherwoods were cut. No, I remember. One of them, they were actually an uncle and a nephew, if I have this right. And the nephew was older than his uncle.
Yeah, that would be about right.
And what, because they, on that Model A Ford, I think they were the first ones that ever let me drive,
Yeah, that sounds right, too.
Drive a motor vehicle more or less on my own. My mother let me drive at a fairly young age. I don't know whether I was...
But they did then.
We did.
Farm kids did.
We were, even though it's a town road down to here, up to the lake and up to Mount Washington... the theory was you didn't need a license to drive when the road wasn't paved. So, which it wasn't paved as far as it is now.
No.
So you could drive down, and then you had to stop the car. And sometimes, literally, we'd drive, particularly that old Plymouth, we'd drive it down, leave it at the end of the dirt road, and walk into town to do whatever we wanted to do. Walk back to the car and drive back up the mountain. But we weren't to drive on the paved road if we didn't have a license.
Oh, my word.
Now, there's no legal...
No, but that's good folklore.
The idea was nobody cared, I guess,
They weren't as strict. My dad was a farm boy, and he was driving, I think, when he was probably 9.
Yeah.
But that's what they did.
Yeah. That's the recollection I have of the Sherwoods.
Oh, lovely.
And one Ball. There were 2 Sherwoods and 1 Ball that worked up there.
All right. You have a guest book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given photocopies of the guest list for the Mountaineers Dance, August 31st, 1907.
Uh-huh.
And that came from Elizabeth McCabe Keith.
Keith, yeah. He's my cousin.
You still have the guest book?
Yeah, well, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you keep it up?
Not very well. We decided a couple years ago we weren't going to write any more in that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we wanted to keep it safer,
but
that we would start another guest book and try to keep it up, and we have done it somewhat. I'm going to go look now and see if anybody's written anything this summer.
In the old guest book, is it preserved in some ways so that it won't be water damaged?
It's in a box, which Beth gave it back to me, and after she had it,
then probably archival,
which is an archival something box, but it's right there up there in the camp on Mount Riga because
that's where it belongs.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to put it up.
That's where it belongs.
Or something. So
that's where it belongs.
You know, if the building burns down, it's going to go. But
this is why I'm gathering as much information as I can.
And Beth has copied, I think, the whole thing.
Probably.
Yeah, she's done a lot.
She's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Tell me about the fireplace tools. They were a wedding gift?
My recollection was that the book says, and my mother, I think, told me the same thing, that they were a housewarming gift from Dwight and Julie Collin to my mother, my grandma, my grandparents, Ambrose and Pauline McCabe, on the occasion of their moving into that camp.
Ah.
That Dwight and Julie were the first guests, first people to sign the book, and that I can attest to, and that they gave them the fireplace instruments for the camp.
That's when I was doing Dwight, he was very specific about how good your people had been to him and his family, and how generous, and really waxed eloquent about this, and was so pleased that there was something in Wish Come True that they'd been able to do as a gift. Oh, my word. You were going to tell me a story. We're going on to parties now. You were going to tell me about a roast sheep.
On a couple of occasions, the first one I remember was up at Wish Come True on the tennis court, as we called the lawn behind the house, because many years ago it was a tennis court. My mother organized a whole roast lamb on a spit. I cannot tell you what the occasion was, whether it was a wedding anniversary, which
there could have been.
My mother and father were both born in June, and their wedding anniversary was in June. But June is not a time when you usually have parties on Mount Riga. It did or not. But I remember how it was done, building a not a deep pit, but a thing in the ground and putting a lot of stones in it and building a fire and putting a pipe and
letting it roast.
The animal on the pipe, and as a matter of fact, I learned from that one that you got to bore some holes in the pipe and put some wire through it, because otherwise you turn the pipe and the animal stays.
And you want it roasted on all sides.
You want to be able to turn it. That's the whole idea of a spit. And when they opened the tennis courts in the 1950, early 50s, I think, we were still at Castanook, and they decided they were going to roast a lamb in the field by the forge, which, of course, is really a blast furnace.
Oh, yeah.
We always call it the forge. And at that point, we were old enough to tend the fire. And the thing was, you had to get a big pile of wood, and you had to start early in the morning and build a fire and let the whole fire burn down. And a friend of mine from White Plains, and Billy Gallagher, was there with me. We were, of course, staying at Castanook. And we were given this detail to keep the fire going from 8 o'clock in the morning until whenever they were going to start cooking. And then they put the meat on there, but they didn't stay there. We just had to sort of tend the fire and do something. Not touch it, but
just make sure that it would
watch things. And the whole crowd of them, my mother and probably my father, Frank Collin, Van Griggs, Charlie Sawtell, and his wife, and actually Frank's wife, Margaret, probably Jim Dresser, Jimmy's father, and they're all up on the Sawtell's porch, which is Wentworth.
Yep.
Which now they've got a sort of deck around, but this was a little porch towards the road.
Yes.
There, which was not all that big.
I've seen pictures of that.
And so they're all up there having a party and drinking and shouting and almost falling over the banister because there were so many people up there. We were not up there. We were not supposed to be drinking then. We were down there tending the fire. And this carload of people from obvious New York City, from their clothes, their accents, and everything, and the cameras. In those days, of course, people carried cameras around their neck, and they were big. And they came up, and they parked by the bridge there on the road and walked over to where we were, the fire, and asked about the forge, which had been reconstructed at that time. Looked like it, pretty much like it looks now. And asked something about, and then they wanted to know, where is the deserted village? Because there was a road map by either Texaco or Esso that had a little thing on there that said, Mount Braga, deserted village. Mm-hmm. It was on the road map. Where's the deserted village? So we were standing there and he looked up and said, no, it didn't say deserted. It said ghost town. Mount Raga ghost town.
Oh my.
Is what it said. So they said, well, where is the ghost town? So we just looked up and here's all this raucous noise going on up there on the thing. And said, right there. And they sort of looked at me like we were crazy or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't even remember if they took a picture. They just, of course, we had no shoes on and no shirts. And, the way we usually were then.
Have you ever heard of the Road to Babylon? Because there was a little hamlet of about three cabins called Babylon.
Out there.
Okay. No, I have to source that one up.
I know about it.
Tell me about the square dances at Mount Washington.
Well, they were at the church at the crossroads up there. Mm-hmm. And when we were teenagers, somebody got the idea that it would be fun to go to these dances. I don't know whether we were invited or not. We were welcome, so.
Oh, yeah.
But, that we should take Chiefy and the farm cart and put all the kids in there and go up. I don't think we actually had hay in it. I think we had more like pillows and
probably
stuff.
Yeah,
but and go up there, and I think people did come by cars also, but or there was more than one occasion. I think it was more or less one time. No, I think some summer we went more than one time. I think they had them every week or
I think we did have them weekly.
And it was quite popular.
Oh, sure.
It was quite popular.
Oh, yeah.
I remember getting cowboy boots, and I think it probably had something to do with the square dances.
Yes, it would. That would be part of the attire.
We never wore shoes otherwise.
Oh, no. This is a special occasion.
So it was good fun, and we went up there. And
it would be, you'd take the girls and the boys from
Oh, the girls and the boys, yeah.
Okay.
In my generation, there were always more girls.
Yeah, I gathered that.
There was more girls. There were two Sawtell boys, but all the other family, and one girl. But all the other families seemed to just produce more girls.
And when you had Mount Riga parties, where were they located? Were they in various...
They were in various places. The ones I remember best were at the farmhouse, the Collins, or in our living room at Wish Come True, which, of course, during most of the year was probably my Uncle Ambrose's. But they were at Frank McCabe's, they were at the Dressers, and...
So I moved around.
They were a very normal occurrence.
I mean,
it was pretty much what people did on nights on the weekend was, you know.
Sure.
And, but the reason for those is that there were pianos in those two places.
Yep.
And somebody, usually Margaret Collins, but somebody would play the piano and everybody would sing.
Yep.
And actually in the farmhouse sometimes, Bim Collins, when he was at Yale, and for years after, but starting when he was at Yale, he was very much into real old-time country music, playing the banjo,
mm-hmm.
and he used to bring friends up from Yale who were very good, and so they would sometimes sing. That was more like a performance, but it never stopped us from singing. We would sing all the time.
And you said that the liquid refreshment was generally beer.
Generally beer. I mean, to have a party, you pretty much...
Had to have a keg of beer.
I mean, not that people didn't drink bottled beer in the time, too, but sort of the idea when you have a party, you go get a keg of beer, or two kegs of beer. Actually, when they had softball games, they used to have a keg of beer out by the backstop in the softball game.
The Mountain Lions and the Lilies of the Valley.
The Lilies of the Valley would play softball, yes.
You see, I have done my homework.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, you've heard from some of these people, so yes.
It makes it a little easier on me. What haven't I asked you before we close that I should? Or what would you like to add to this interview before we close?
I think one thing, there's a couple things. One, during my childhood, the mill was still operating down here on the road. And
grist mill?
Grist
mill?
No, the wood mill. They used to make wood, Salisbury Artisans.
Oh, Salisbury Artisans, yes.
And so they used the water from the lake to run the mill. So during the summer, the lake level would go down.
Sure.
Now, pretty much, it's low now because it hasn't rained, so people have gotten used to now the lake sort of being full mm-hmm. all the time. I think that is affecting the quality of the water and the amount of organic material growing in the lake. I'm not advocating running out the water, but I'm just saying that I think
it makes a difference.
When the mill shut down, we effectively changed a water management policy without giving it any thought as to the consequences of it. Just because we always wanted to have more water. Yeah, we'd like to have more water for swimming and boating and whatever. And the other thing related to the lakes is when I was a kid, I remember when the first sunfish came, they were a kit. And you had a sailfish.
Oh, yeah.
Sailfish. And you had to buy it and put it together and so forth. Before that, sailboats were bigger, and it was very hard to sail on Mount Riga. There were a couple of boats, but they were... And the sails were made of canvas.
Mm-hmm.
If you tipped the boat over, it took a full day...
To dry it out.
To dry it out, and you had to drag it on the shore, and it was hard. And so sailing wasn't nearly as much fun, although we tried it a little bit,
mm-hmm.
as now. I think that's sort of the nylon sails and the little things like sunfish and sailfish. And now they have paddle boards and all that. So that's a change that I think is sort of worth documenting.
Absolutely. Because that's the whole point of how things have changed mm-hmm. from your candles to your kerosene to the generators to whatever. Yeah. This has been absolutely fabulous. Thank you so very much.
Oh, you're welcome.